Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Now joining us from Fan 590 in Toronto, and also you're hearing him on the 32 Thoughts podcast these days during the Stanley Cup playoffs, he is Justin Cuthbert. Justin, thanks for doing this. How are you?
Not a problem, fellas. Doing pretty good.
We were saying in the first segment, like we've been doing the sports radio thing long enough now to know one of the spiciest, most emotional days in our industry from our listeners' perspective is the day after a player on the home team leaves the game after a perceived dirty hit. So what's been the mood? What's been the tenor of the conversation in Toronto today following the Sam Bennett, Anthony Stolarz incident last night?
Oh, it's been unbelievable. I think it hit every all the check boxes for kind of the perfect storm in terms of controversy and online discourse. And it is that way because, like, I don't think we can actually track down exactly how Anthony Stolarz got hurt last mm-hmm. night. I mean, the slap shot off the chin and the shaking of the head afterwards, I think that can't be discounted. It definitely felt like more of a violent impact than what we saw from Sam Bennett. But again, he stayed in the game and tried to gut it out. And then there's vomiting on the bench. And there's a repeat offender in Sam Bennett who seems to never really go fully across the line, but is threatening it at all times. Habitual line stepper, or at least someone who's habitually getting to the line in his case. It just feels like everything that could annoy a Maple Leafs fan other than the result kind of happened last night, because everyone in Toronto or everyone who covers or watches the Maple Leafs seems to feel like the league is against the Maple Leafs, which is the silliest thing going, at least in my opinion. But if you look at the track record from DOPS, Department of Player Safety, it does feel that way sometimes because it seems to never go the way of the Maple Leafs. And I guess everyone already sort of chalked that into this category or placed it into that bin because, yeah, it's the precedent. It's the history. It's the torment of George Parros in this market that seems to be triggering most people. But I think the biggest thing is, like, Anthony Stolarz has finally brought quality goaltending in a Stanley Cup final caliber way to this city. And the fact that he was taken out on a stretcher is certainly going to get the attention and draw the ire of people in this market. But, you know, I've seen Sam Bennett do far worse, if I'm being honest.
A tepid defense, Justin.
Yeah, it is a tepid defense, but you don't want to go too far down the road, because if you are truly honest about what you saw, I feel like, in this market right now, people are going to come after you.
Yeah, you're all the way on the West Coast here, Justin. You can be honest. This is a safe space. We promise we won't post this clip on social media.
I appreciate that.
It's an interesting one for me, Justin, because I think if you're saying, like, if the argument you want to have or the conversation someone wants to have is the league should be regulating hits to the head and especially contact with goaltenders differently than they do, more harshly than they do, I think you'll find a sympathetic ear with me. If your argument is that based on the league's standard as it exists today, that he deserved to be suspended, I really struggle with that.
Oh, I'm 100% with you. I mean, I saw it last night, and you're watching all the replays, and, you know, some of them look worse than others. Some look like there's very minimal contact.
Yeah, but depending on the frame rate, too.
Definitely depends on the frame rate. But the main conclusion I drew from watching every single replay is that there's no way Sam Bennett was going to get suspended. They're not going to look at everything he's done in the past and just make this bigger than it actually was. That's just not generally how they go about it. And I'm interested. I got Carter Hart on my show later on tonight, and I'm interested to hear from him how often he would absorb contact like that on a nightly basis, on a weekly basis, monthly? Like, how often would you take a shot like that? Because it feels like goaltenders have taken far worse. It feels like goaltenders, especially active ones, are always involved in contact, and you don't normally get that reaction. I'm not trying to be sort of glib about the situation or trivialize it, because Anthony Solares was clearly in distress last night. But that felt like if there was no reaction from Solares, nobody paid even a second of attention to it.
And the other element about this I find fascinating now going forward for the Leafs is, because it is Sam Bennett, right? Like, if this had been Carter Verhaeghe bumping in to Anthony Stolarz in the crease, probably not as much conversation, probably not as much, you know, bloodlust and demand for revenge as I'm sure there's been from fans in Toronto. But it is Sam Bennett, right? And we all know Sam Bennett's history. It's going to be a bigger deal because it's him involved. How much of a threat to the Leafs' composure is this, do you think, for the rest of the series, right? That yeah, they won the game, but now is there any danger of them being preoccupied with Sam Bennett, with this idea of, hey, we got to send a message, we got to respond?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I mean, previous iterations of this team, definitely, like Nazem Kadri 5, 6, 7 years ago, would have taken two hands and went at Sam Bennett's teeth, for sure. And a couple years ago, I'm sure under Sheldon Keefe, there probably would have been a reaction, maybe a forced reaction from someone because you felt like you had to do something. But with Craig Berube, I mean, the message all along has been, and what's really shone through in these playoffs as far as differences from one regime to the next, is they are not worried about what's going on the other side. Like, everything is internal. Everything is about their own process. Everything is about just handling what's right in front of them and keeping a level head. And so far, that's been the mix. Like, you look at Sheldon Keefe in previous years, he wore the emotions of the fan base, on his face at all times. And with Craig Berube, we finally got a reaction last night, and it was because he just didn't understand how Max Domi got a penalty early on in that game. Like, that was the first real moment of him being incredulous or showing some sort of disdain with the officials. Like, sometimes he can glare, but Craig Berube is as level-headed, 7 out of 10, maybe 6 out of 10, at all times. Like, he just does not waver from that, and I feel like the message will be to simply ignore it, whereas I think this team has before felt pressure to be something they're not. Like, step up, defend yourself, like, be tougher, because that's not who you really are. But if you got to win, if you want to win, you have to be that. I don't think they're like that anymore. I don't think they are forcing themselves to be something they're not. I think they're going to just look at their own paper tonight or tomorrow night and moving forward, and it really won't become an issue, I guess, until Sam Bennett does it again. I mean, we look back 2 years, he took out Matthew Nyes. Last year, took out Brad Marchand and other teammates. And this year, it looks like he may have taken out Anthony Stolarz. So who might be next?
Who might be next? The
the Sam Bennett story. Who's next?
Canadian hero Sam Bennett. Remember, on this program, he must always be referred to as such. Okay, I'm curious to get your take moving from the thrilling game one between Florida and Toronto last night to just your view from the East Coast, the view of the Laurentian elite, Justin, of what's gone on in Vancouver over the course of this offseason. Can you summarize how you're processing all of the news coming from the Canucks organization?
Oh my goodness. Where to start? I feel like the power that Quinn Hughes has absorbed or taken on here over the last couple months, 6, 8 months, whatever it may be, has been like dramatic and almost dangerous to an extent. Like, it just feels like, not that he has the franchise over a barrel or he's playing this leverage game that is put this team in a situation where there's no winning, there's no getting out of it. But it feels like all the backdrop specter of Quinn Hughes in a couple years is something that's almost paralyzing or not allowing the team to make decisions or act in a way that would be composed, if that makes any sense. And I'm not saying it should be different, because you have to placate to your superstars. You have to make sure they are happy. But if it gets to a situation where hey, we can't do this because of that, or hey, we can't go this way because of that, or hey, we can't do what's right because we may have to have this difficult conversation, or we may just frankly lose this player, then I don't know. Is there any winning playing that game? It's a little alarming, and I don't know how much of it is actually Quinn Hughes. I don't know how much of it is, this false or confirmation bias that seems to be maybe at play. But it just feels like from the pure outsider standpoint that this one player who is so, so important, who has all this power and can soon do what they wish, is kind of getting in the way of sound hockey decision making.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely something to that. As much as I understand when you have a player who, as you said, is so important and does so much for them on the ice, far and away their best, most consistent player, I completely get prioritizing what that player wants. But I also think at the end of the day, like the vast majority, maybe all, every single NHL player kind of wants the same thing, which is to win and be competitive, right? And so you almost just need to step back and stop filtering everything through the lens of what does Quinn Hughes want to, what's the best thing for our organization? What's the best thing short term, medium term, long term to make us a consistent winning operation? Because I think that ultimately is going to be what satisfies Quinn Hughes more than, well, we're hiring a coach he has a previous relationship with.
And this is such a turn, right? Because, you know, at this time last year, we're talking about an unbelievable success story, like the start of something truly special with Rick Tocchet and a team that was, sorry, I'm driving, I don't know if you hear that, a team that is, you know, not exceeding expectations per se, but arriving to the destination a little bit early, and all these positive vibes, and how, you know, it felt like you finally had this elite coach and you finally had a group that was going to be able to build, and it was all going to come together. And then it's one thing after another. And then naturally it gets to the point where Quinn Hughes is looking around thinking, you know, I only have one of these, that being a career. And am I going to, you know, be a part of something that continues to devolve and devolve and devolve? And again, it hasn't been that long. As I mentioned, it's only been, you know, the contents of a year, but, you know, a year changes everything. And I know I'm understating that given that you guys have followed every single moment this year, but it's remarkable how much things have changed here in 12 months.
We were talking in the last segment about Manny Malhotra because of a skeet sent by my Athletic colleague, Rob Rossi, suggesting that Malhotra might be a perfect fit for the Pittsburgh Penguins. We know that Kyle Dubas hired him when he was the general manager in Toronto to serve on Sheldon Keefe's staff. What can you tell us about Malhotra's tenure in Toronto and his sort of overall candidacy, as you see it anyway, to be a head coach in this cycle?
So Malhotra was a bit of a punchline for us in and around the team in the last couple of years, because it felt like every year he moved further and further away from the bench. Mm-hmm. He would go from, yeah, I'm beside Sheldon Keefe, to I'm, you know, furthest away from Sheldon Keefe on the bench, to, well, now I'm in the press box wearing an earpiece, and now I'm, you know, even further away somewhere else in the most recent season. It just felt like, you know, if power was centralized around one figure, that being Sheldon Keefe, he was losing it every single year. He didn't really have a concrete role with the organization by the time his tenure was wrapping up. And honestly, I couldn't even tell you what he did in the final year he was with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I'm not even trying to be funny. Like, I actually have no idea what the role and responsibility was for him by the end. He definitely lost power over time with the Maple Leafs. He lost influence. It seemed like he was just kind of along for the ride by the end of it, and it was not a surprise to anyone that covers the Leafs that his time with the Maple Leafs did end.
Looking at the other Canadian teams still in action here, Justin, of course, the Oilers get going against the Golden Knights tonight in the Western Conference. And, you know, the Oilers down 2-0 in that series against LA, and then completely flip things and storm back. And you're reminded, yeah, for all of the flaws in roster construction and the holes on that team, they still have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. Stronger opponent now, but do you think that top end star power will be enough to carry the Oilers through this series?
Yeah, I'm believing again. I'm not going to lie to you. I like the Kings before the series. Certainly like the Kings after two games in the series and deep into game three. But everybody beyond Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl snap to attention at a certain point, and all of a sudden you bring Evander Kane back and you have a middle six line that's really working and that's dangerous, and that's something beyond the top line partnership that they chose to go with between McDavid and Draisaitl. I mean, Evan Bouchard was an absolute mess defensively. How could they ever get through the loss of Matthias Ekholm? But they make a couple changes to the lineup early in that series, and they settle things down just a little bit. I just can't really get over the transformation, especially deep in the lineup. Like guys like Connor Brown, Matthias Janmark, not having great seasons whatsoever. We're great last year in the playoffs, but we're kind of non-factors in the regular season and certainly early in that playoff series. All of a sudden, everybody started going, especially among the forward group. So it feels like they found something. It feels like something just clicked for that group, and they started playing like the Edmonton Oilers of last year's Stanley Cup playoffs. I think the most interesting thing is I was very, very disappointed with what I saw from Vegas. Like, I don't want to diminish Kirill Kaprizov and Matt Boldy, but they ran wild all over the Vegas Golden Knights in that series, which, you got to go and think to yourself, what are McDavid and Draisaitl going to do if that Vegas team couldn't handle those two? And again, it might be not quite apples to apples, but at least of the same sort of size and weight of fruit. So I just feel like that Vegas team with Adin Hill didn't look great. The defense is great on paper. Are they getting a little older? Are they getting a little slower? They certainly looked that against the Minnesota Wild. That Vegas team, they had a great regular season. They have pedigree, but I'm worried about them here. I think Edmonton could potentially run them out of the buildings in this series, but I was wrong earlier about the Oilers, so maybe I'm wrong about this one too.
Where's your level of confidence in Connor Hellebuck going into the Jets Stars series?
Pretty low. I'm not sure what one brief recovery, how that will change things. Like, this is a goaltender who was clearly and absolutely lost in that series. He has his teammates to thank for that miracle comeback, clearly. The way that they were trying desperately to not let anything in overtime get near the net, I thought was telling. But this guy gave up a bad goal or two or three in pretty much every game. He got pulled every time he was away from Winnipeg. I don't know if he can just turn it around. He should be able to just turn it around because he's the best goaltender on the planet, probably going to win the Hart Trophy, and I don't know how that's going to look when we get there. But something is clearly amiss there, and if it was just, hey, I need a win, a series win on the ledger to feel good about myself again, then maybe. But this Dallas Stars team is leaps and bounds ahead of the St. Louis Blues for me. They are an absolute juggernaut, the Dallas Stars, and Winnipeg doesn't have even 8.5, 9 out of 10 Connor Hellebuck, I feel like it could be pretty ugly pretty quickly, given the state of that Dallas Stars team right now.
Justin, really appreciate the time. Thank you for doing this, and best of luck dealing with the emotion and the anger there in Toronto today.
Thanks, fellas. I'll do my best to dodge all ammunition fired my way.
That's right. That is Justin Cuthbert from Fan 590 and the 32 Thoughts podcast, weighing in on Sam Bennett and also everything happening out here with the Canucks as well. We have an update on the NHL coaching carousel, but before we do that, time for One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. As we look at the schedule tonight, two second round series get going. First, it's the Hurricanes and the Capitals, but I'm focusing on the Oilers and the Golden Knights. And my one to watch on the Vegas side, I picked Vegas to win this series, is Jack Eichel. You just heard Justin talk about what Kaprizov and Boldy were able to do against Vegas, especially early in that series against Jack Eichel. Started to change once William Karlsson was moved up to play with him. Yep. But yeah, it's great if William Karlsson is there to offer support, but ultimately it has to come from Jack Eichel. He needs to be a difference maker. It's not about shutting down McDavid or shutting down Draisaitl. You're not going to do that. But you have to be at least able to slow them down a little bit and then produce on your own too. So Jack Eichel, the key player for me in this series. We know how elite he can be in the playoffs. We saw it when Vegas won the cup a couple of years ago. He needs to get back to that level consistently in this series against Edmonton for Vegas to go on and win.
Yeah, I'm going to be watching. There's this very, very good hockey player,
Connor McDavid,
right there on the Capitals.
Ooh.
He's a big, tough cookie, too. Just broke the record. Great Canadian, Alex Ovechkin. I'm going to be watching him closely.
Yeah, Canadian hero, Alex Ovechkin. I remember him at the 2010 Olympics, Team Canada.
The pride.
Weird we don't talk about that more.
The pride of Moose Jaw. Alex Ovechkin.
Alex Ovechkin. Incredible. all right. That is One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. It's time to put on your Toyo tires. Whether you drive a car, light truck, or van, Toyo tires are designed to perform in all kinds of conditions. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Aldergrove. We'll take a break in just a second here. As mentioned, a little update from the coaching search world in the NHL that we can get into. I thought it was pretty interesting what Cuthbert had to say about Malhotra's tenure.
Has a potential vacancy been put to Bednar?
Yes, it has. Exactly. I thought it was pretty interesting what Cuthbert had to say about the less than successful or impactful tenure for Manny Malhotra in Toronto. Not to disparage Malhotra, because we've seen what he's done for Abbotsford, but specifically as a kind of caveat or extra bit of context to the connection between Malhotra and Kyle Dubas, who was in Toronto while all of that was unfolding, and who is now in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I think the truth is that being a head coach and an assistant coach are very different skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that Malhotra was put in a position to succeed, like brought in around the power play, something that, you know, he didn't really do as a player.
Yep.
Right? And something that he hadn't done with the Canucks. He was eye in the sky, general assignment development coach when he was in Vancouver. So, look, I don't know that he was put in a position to succeed as an assistant coach. We've seen his work as a head coach. You know, whether or not he slowly lost a power struggle on that coaching staff or however it went, there's still experiences and nuances and things to learn being in that environment. To me, what matters far more is that when given a shot as a head coach, he's crushed it.
Yeah.
Because, again, very different skill sets.
Well, and I wouldn't even go as far to say, like, well, Kyle Dubas saw it not go well for him in Toronto, and therefore he'd be out on Malhotra.
He might have a more textured understanding
exactly.
of
he might
why.
Be like, man, it didn't work out, but I saw a lot I liked, right?
Yeah, or it didn't work out. We should have used him more.
Yes, sure. Man, I wish we had done this differently with him. Yeah, but I still remain high on him. So interesting context, but doesn't necessarily change that there could be an attraction there for the Pittsburgh job, as Rob Rossi alluded to and we mentioned earlier in the show. We'll take a break. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in. We can get back more into what the Canucks should do with the 15th overall pick, what they're likely to do. Who do you want to see them target in a trade? Who do you want to see them pick if they hold on to the pick, if they do in fact make that 15th overall selection? Lots more on the other side here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz here. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. As mentioned, just an update from the NHL coaching world per Elliot Friedman relaying the commentary from Colorado general manager Chris McFarland, who says it is 100% that Jared Bednar remains the team's head coach. And not a big surprise to me there. I mean, I know John Cooper's name had come up, maybe hopefully from people here in the market, given his BC roots, that, hey, if Tampa loses in the first round again, could he be out? Same thing with Jared Bednar. But there's just so much stability in both of those positions with both of those organizations. It was tough to see either of them moving on at this point, and now officially that both of them will remain with their organization. So no extra opening, no very experienced Stanley Cup winning head coach in Jared Bednar hitting the market either. He will stay with Colorado. All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So Canucks officially picking 15th in the draft. The Islanders and Utah win the lotteries, the two lotteries. So Islanders picking first overall, Utah jumps up to fourth overall. Let's say, let's throw out a crazy hypothetical here and say that the Canucks pick at 15. They do not trade the pick. The value isn't there. They're not checking the boxes they want in the trade market with that pick. So they step up to the podium and they make the pick. Drance, I know you. I'm guessing you already have some targets in the middle of that round that interest you.
Yeah, absolutely. Easy.
That you're excited about. So we've heard, so number one,
well, just
for me,
profiles that I like. Yeah.
We've heard Ben Kindle, local product, playing in the Dub, went down to the U18s, I believe, as well with Team Canada just recently. And of course, Jason Bukla brought him originally to our contention, or to our attention. Center, productive,
does a lot of stuff.
Does a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, I honestly, I like Kindle a lot. Like, I like Kindle probably more than a lot of the guys being mocked in and around.
There.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or it, or in and around, like the centerman. First of all, I think he can stick at center based on,
sure,
you know, what my most trusted Dub watchers seem to think about him. But you know, generally speaking, you're looking at guys like Nesbitt, and what's the other guy? Nesbitt and Coots.
Brady Martin.
Well, Brady Martin's going to go top 10.
Yeah.
Sorry, if Brady Martin...
No, but I mean, like, around 10.
If Brady Martin was going to go 15, he'd be a clear yes, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, you run up and make the bet.
Yeah, but that's why he's not going to be there. Because everyone from 10 on is going to feel that way.
Yep.
You know, the other part of this is there's always a guy who you don't expect to be available at 15 who ends up being available at 15, right? I mean, Victor Eklund... Right,
yes.
Shorter, 160 yep. pound winger. You know, that to me, like his compete, he's got some dog in him, man. And obviously the offensive tools where he shouldn't be available at 15, but he could be available at 15. That to me feels like a Lekkerimäki 2.0 sort of pick.
I ran that past Bukala, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's actually kind of eerie how similar the profiles are from a height and everything stance. And then what happens, right? Slightly undersized guy at a non-premium position, and you get he's always produced, right? But then you get closer to the draft process, and hey, here's Roger McQueen. He's a 6'5" center, right? And yeah, he starts to climb up, and oh, this really athletic right shot defenseman who didn't produce very much, but he starts to climb up the draft boards, and then a guy like Eklund slips, right? That's how the Canucks got Lekkerimäki. He was projected 7th, 8th, 9th in that draft, and he fell to 15th.
This, I mean, my real guy though in this draft, just to flag plant it now, is this Caleb Desnoyers kid out of Moncton in the QMJHL. Just like absolute mega dog.
He is definitely not. He's like a top five.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Type. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think what you don't want to see is Utah take that guy.
Right.
Because, I mean, Utah's in the conference and they're going to get now another high-end player, and mm-hmm, that sucks. Right? Like, that's a problem. Utah was already in a position where, you know, I think you can flip a coin. We'll see sort of what both teams do to upgrade this summer. But, I mean, I think you can flip a coin going into this summer in terms of which team will finish ahead of the other one next year. Right? I mean, if Utah is able to bring in, like, one or two more top six wingers, like, they're going to look really complete and really scary overall, I think. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But where, you know, if you're able to bump Nick Schmaltz down the lineup and upgrade there, I mean, that – Gunther is sick. Cooley is sick. Keller is sick. They beat the Canucks in all three meetings they had head-to-head this past season. They finished only 1 point shy of Vancouver. And in the top four, you know, probably not getting a guy that contributes next year. Probably, but not definitely. Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely,
yeah, you never
not
know.
Definitely. So, I mean, I think guys like Desnoyers and Martone could potentially push to play in that lineup immediately. So... Kayshawn Aitchison's an interesting defender, right? There's some really interesting defenders there. I like Justin Carboneau.
Okay.
Generally, just be as a guy who's got like a power forward type frame and some offensive juice, like real offensive juice. He's a guy that stands out to me. And then there's the Lyndon Lakovich. 6'4" winger out of Moose Jaw, had some disciplinary issues, so may sort of fall, but just like physical tools for days and a really impressive offensive profile. Carter Bear. Those are some of the guys that sort of stand out to me.
Do you have a Cole Reshny take out of Victoria?
I don't.
Very productive. Yeah, I don't either.
I don't.
I am still in like hockey DB scouting mode where it's like, hey, 92 points in 62 games in your draft year in the dub. All right.
Yeah, no, I mean, no, look,
I'll listen.
I like the productivity. Not huge.
No.
Not a center, really. Right. Like seen as a guy who's probably a winger and not a burner. So, you know, there's some question marks there. But I mean, I love the statistical profile. So I think that would be a great pick.
The other thing is, I find it because I like Ben Kindle. OK, and he's a little undersized, but he's super productive. And I look at that profile and I just have a knee jerk reaction, which is like, it doesn't feel like a Canucks pick. I don't think the Canucks will pick him. And I don't know if that's entirely fair because I've been trying to think about it. Like, what is the profile we should expect the Canucks to target if they do make the 15th overall pick? They've only made two first round picks. This management group, Villander and Lekkerimäki. They haven't made any second round picks. And they don't have one again this year.
Yeah, we can kind of parse some things together, though, in terms of who they liked.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I think they would have been thrilled. Well, I think they were pretty set on Villander, right?
It seems like it.
They definitely weren't taking an undersized winger, but they definitely would have taken Michkov if he fell.
Sure, right?
So they definitely, I think they're pretty focused on upside in the first round. I think they've done a pretty good job of that. I do think they allowed positional need or the idea of, you know, taking an undersized winger basically being like off the board for them in 2023. So I don't love that. We know that in the Lekkerimäki draft, like the real apple of their eye was Marco Kasper, who ultimately went to Detroit, didn't fall far enough for them. But they were thrilled to get a shot at Lekkerimäki. So, you know, generally speaking, I think they've done a pretty good job under this new management group of just kind of taking the value that's there. I think I'd like to see a little bit more discipline with it in the middle rounds. I know Ty Mueller, for example, played for them this year.
Yep.
But, you know, that's not the sort of profile that I would like to see this team really pick. I want to see them shoot for more upside than that. I prefer the picks like the Brustevich pick or the Ulrichsson pick, right, where you're like really going, you know, taking the big cut, the big home run cut. I think you need that because I don't think there's any benefit to drafting a third line player. Like, I'd rather this management group find a third line player on July 1 for $1.5 million. They rock at that. You know, and
absolutely.
And by the way, that's not a reason why you can afford to trade these picks. You know?
Yeah.
It's a reason to be really conscious of taking, like, oh yeah, this like super fast, you know, Russian player who hasn't put it together has contractual issues or what have you. Like, you know, I just want to see upside swings. And I think they've been better about that in the first round than they have been throughout the draft order, I think, in this management group sort of time. Like Fernstrom was a perfect example, right? Riley Patterson, honestly, was a pretty good example, too. And Romani. I think they did a better job of it in some ways last year with less draft capital.
Right. Yeah. And all that to say is just, you know, because somebody texted in which Swedish players are projected outside the top 10, right? That's how you know. That's from a really good pickle. That's how you know who they're going to take. And, I mean, it's easy to make those jokes. Obviously, if Patrick Alvin is the Swedish general manager and they've taken two Swedes with their two first-round picks, there's obviously some interest and familiarity there with doing that. But that's not to say they're only going to draft Swedish players. And this year, if Eklund doesn't fall like Lekkerimäki does, they're in, like, a Swedish dead zone in where they're picking if they do step up to make the pick. Right now at this stage of the process, it doesn't look like there's going to be Swedish players kind of mocked in that range or expected to go in that range. And so it's just interesting to me to kind of think like what I don't have a firm sense of, hey, this is a Canucks first round prospect type guy. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have a clear vision of what that means. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because as you said, there's a lot of value to be had in not honing in on somebody, right? And just being like, hey, we're going to see how things fall. There's a bunch of good players and we're going to take what gives us the most value. We're not locked in on a certain profile of player. We're flexible.
No, I mean, I guess with Lekkerimäki and Villander, you know, one thing that they share is they had an immediate projectable NHL level tool.
Right.
Right off the hop. Like that.
So the shot and the skating.
The shot and the speed.
Yeah.
And I think that would be the sort of commonality between them.
Okay, that's interesting.
Even more so, so maybe you're looking for the guy with the one...
With the tool that pops.
The tool that pops.
Yeah. All right, I like that. I'm going to I'm going to test that out.
Yeah, we'll see if that makes sense. The one guy who's got, yeah, the one thing you can count on, the thing that, you know, you assume that they'll be able to bank on.
Yeah.
In terms of sort of what's next.
All right, I like that. That's and I guess that the other thing would be, as you said, with Philander, definitely letting the positional need in your prospect pool play a role in it, and that would obviously point towards center.
Yeah,
this year,
so. Right? So, so that would be like a Carboneau's got the shot,
right?
So that might be something to sort of look for as like a separating skill, like one guy who's got just a preposterous tool. You know, the Kayshon Aitchison kid is like one of the biggest junior hitters we've seen in a decade.
Mm.
Right? It's just like absolute masher.
That's interesting. I mean, I wanted to talk about DPD actually anyways, right? Like, you want to start building an organizational identity?
Yeah.
Just draft like the biggest hitting team in the draft every year?
Have I ever done my thing about linebacker numbers?
No, I don't think so.
I've always thought that an NHL defense corps should get together and all wear number 50, like 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Then they make the players look so wide. The number, like 55, makes you look so much wider as a defensive group. I just like, why do defensive groups never have like a standalone identity, like the old, yeah, Legion of Boom secondary, yeah, or like the New York Sack Exchange? Like, why do we never get that in hockey?
Having a
Wouldn't
bunch of guys
sick?
With like Brian Urlacher and Ray Lewis numbers out there, yeah, would be pretty sick, actually, I gotta say.
Yeah, like every defenseman wears 55.
The 50, other way to do amazing. It, the other way to do it, although I guess this maybe would make more sense for like your big wingers, would be like the edge rusher numbers. Like, you, like 96, 97, 98.
Yeah, all your F1.
Sprinting down the wings to go in and crash the defenseman.
Yeah. I mean, I've always wanted an NHL blue line group to commit to wearing like a uniform wide body number. So you can do it with eight. You can do it with the eights. You, yep, can do it with the nines, or you can do it with the fives. And I just think it would be cool. I think it would be cool, especially if you had a bunch of guys who hit to hurt.
That would be awesome. Speaking of DPD, we didn't really talk about this yesterday on the show, but I know you had some notes on him in your latest kind of roundup Canucks notebook up at The Athletic. And we were talking about the kind of ranking of future assets that the Canucks have to potentially deal, right? Where the 15th overall pick in this year's draft slots in relative to Lekkomäki, relative to Velander, relative to the 2026 pick. And we've known for a while now, and we've got to see for our own eyes why, but we've known for a while now that the organization is very, very excited about DPD, defenseman Elias Pettersson, not just what he did this year, but what he might be able to do for this team in the future. And I know you had some extra context about that. You know, it's not just about what he's capable of doing on the ice, but some of the leadership qualities, the work ethic, all of those things, the character that DPD brings off the ice as well has really become a major selling point for him within the organization.
Yeah, he's become a favorite of the Sedin twins. Henrik and Daniel Sedin, okay, has become an absolute favorite of theirs and beyond. Like, I think the way that he's fit into that locker room, the way he's carried himself, I think the organization has sort of looked at, you know, there's a certain authority that he, mm-hmm, carries himself with plays with.
Yeah. I mean, again, we can all see that. It doesn't take long to catch that, no, right? When you sit down and watch, you're like, oh, wow.
Or when you hear him talk, or, yeah, just like the way he carries himself, right? I think, especially coming out of last season, I really think there's, like, put it this way. The Canucks are going to have to take on some level of pain,
mm-hmm,
to accomplish what they want to accomplish in terms of their top six forward group.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I'd add this, that like haunted in some ways by the ghosts of draft picks unused, right?
Yep.
This club needs multiple top six guys and needs to do so with less weaponry, less overall asset capital than most of the other teams, the Montreals and the Minnesotas, that are going to be hunting for similar players,
mm-hmm,
over the course of the summer, which is a really challenging spot to be. As the Canucks sort of go through it, I mean, there are multiple areas where there's at least some surplus that the club, not that they're going to want to do these trades, but where the club can at least consider selling from. And one of those spots is defense, clearly. Now, that's not going to be Hughes. It's not going to be Myers, right? It's not going to be Elias Pettersson, as I've said. It's not going to be Marcus Pettersson.
Is it going to be Filip Hronek?
It's not going to be Filip
Hronek. I don't
think so. It's not going to be Filip Hronek. Okay. So, you know, Mancini's sort of interesting. They're definitely very enamored with the tools, and he's playing really well down in Abbotsford. Could it be Sawyer Mineo? They'd prefer it not to be, but he'd have some cachet.
If Sawyer Mineo has really interesting prospect and a draft success story with where they got him.
But he has cachet.
Then you trade him.
Okay.
Like, right?
Well, I'm just saying, as they go through it and think through some of these moves that they absolutely do not want to make, you do not want to trade organizationally a guy who's trended the way Sawyer Mineo has. You know, as they sort of think through that, like one guy who just is not going to be made available, one guy they are not going to trade is Elias Pettersson. Like Elias Pettersson is locked in. I wouldn't call him like a core piece, but he's the next level there. And honestly, this has been like a slow moving trend. I mean, how many times have I reported this? Like last year when they got close to the deadline and were like really considering what it would take to, you know, swing big on a Gensel and on and on. Elias Pettersson was like an absolute non-starter for them there then too. Like they've known and tracked this guy for a bit here as he's sort of gone through his development path, but he's now reached a point of being like a bit virtually untouchable going into the summer.
So would you go as far to say that he has like jumped over Lekkerimäki and Villander in the organization's view, right? Are they similarly untouchable?
Lekkerimäki and Villander?
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious about Villander like given the standoff.
Yeah.
But I still would say most likely untouchable. Now, Lekkerimäki hasn't been playing for Abbotsford. He had a sickness, an illness that caused him game three of the first round.
And then he had oral surgery and there was a complication or something related to it.
I'm not entirely certain if this is health related still or coach's decision, but I think they were very happy with Lekkerimäki. Especially on the management side. I actually think that's one of those things where I'm not certain if Tockett had the same view of it as Alvin and Co.
Yeah.
You know, because I think management was very happy with what they saw in terms of the flashes from Lekkerimäki down the stretch. And I mean, I think we all saw it in drips and drabs. Like, it wasn't an over-the-moon, undeniable audition for a full-time NHL role, but I think it's super reasonable to look at him as a partial answer to Vancouver's scoring issues in sort of like a sheltered middle six scoring role next year, right? I don't think that's asking too much.
Yeah, it's just, to me, if
it's not a lock, but it's not asking too much.
I have no problem with them saying, like, we've got, DPD has these unique characteristics, okay, and we are really excited about it, and we want him around for the long haul, and we're taking him off the table, okay? I get that. If you're also taking both Lekkerimäki and Villander off the table, you're running out of assets to do your work here. Like, we're not talking one trade. We're talking multiple trades in all likelihood if you miss out on the top free agents. So as much as you can sit here and say, well, we want to go all in and we really want to completely change what our top six looks like and bring in two or three players, but you can't take all of your best assets off the table if you're going to do that.
No.
You know what I mean? So it's like I'm there with DPD. Don't get me wrong. That's awesome. I'm glad they're excited about him, but it's just, it almost like bumps somebody else out of an untouchable slot to me.
I mean, I would put it this way though. Like I would think about it in this, through this frame. I don't think it's unreasonable if you were to tell me that you were higher on Elias Pettersson than Tom Villander.
Sure.
I don't think that's an unreasonable take at this point. What do you think?
No, I don't think it's unreasonable. He played in the NHL last year. He played really well in the NHL last year.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen that from Villander.
No.
I don't think it's unreasonable to be more excited about Villander. He's right-handed, and there's a reason he went where he did in the draft and all that, but I don't think it's crazy to recognize how far DPD has come.
Yes. And to have seen him carry himself the way he has, right?
Yeah.
So, but no, I mean, I don't think you have to trade one of those three guys to get what you need to get done this summer. You shouldn't have to anyway.
I kind of think you might.
Well,
I don't know what else you're like.
I mean, you might have to fire all weapons. I think we all understand that, no?
Like,
it's
if you trade the 15th overall pick and then Mancini, Sawyer Mineo, and I'm not just talking about one package, but like, let's say in multiple trades out the door, 15th overall pick, Mancini, Sawyer Mineo, and I don't know, whatever, something else, a second round pick. How much talent does that bring into the organization?
So, is it enough? Mancini, the 15th overall.
15th overall, Mancini.
A second round pick.
Let's say a second round pick in Sawyer Mineo. Not all in one trade necessarily, right? But that's the total volume of assets you're sending out to acquire your top six upgrades. Is that bringing in enough talent? I don't know that it is.
I think it's not. It's probably insufficient because you need the center, and the center is going to be so expensive.
Very expensive.
But I think if you add a Demko or a Garland to that list, it becomes more workable. The other part of this that I'd add is like, Will Borgen, a second and a fourth, brought back Kaapo Kakko. Right? I mean, you know, the team doesn't necessarily have to go only big game hunting. There are ways to target guys who are undervalued, out of favor, right? Now, the Canucks don't have a Will Borgen type in the lineup like Mancini might be. But Mancini in a second returning ex-distressed asset, not Alexis Lafreniere, but like, you know, a player who has disappointed, or a player who's on a second contract that's become viewed by their own team as inefficient.
Yeah.
Like those are the sorts
of... Or is staring down the ARB case or whatever and they don't want to pay it, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Those are the sorts of things that become more interesting. Or like when we were putting together the Josh Norris package and I'm like, and Teddy Bluger's involved.
Yeah.
You know, like, is there a team where, hey, we're going to trade this winger that we don't think is going to figure it out for us, and add a veteran center who we think brings like championship winning experience and, you know, all this good veteran, like, and we've actually value that as an additive part of the package. Right. I mean, that's the sort of, I think pool you have to swim in here if you're the Canucks.
Yeah. I do think when you start to really go through the exercise and also just look at the potential available names, the other teams bidding, which is a factor here as well at the
huge
high end
factor.
You are going to have to really get creative. You're going to have to conduct a wide, wide search here, and you're going to have some tolerance for risk, for taking the guy. Like, yeah, he has been a disappointment, but we think we can get the most out of him. That might be the most realistic path to trying to solve your problems in the top six. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in about how the Canucks should approach this summer, the Stanley Cup playoffs, whatever's on your mind. Hit us up, 650-650. One more segment of Canucks Talk next on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Get your texts in for the final segment here. And I wanted to build off something that Justin Cuthbert brought up when we were chatting with him in the second segment of the show. And you asked him about kind of his perspective from afar, from the other side of the country, about everything happening around the Canucks and everything that has happened around the Canucks since the end of the regular season. And what he brought up was just kind of awe at the amount of power that has come to rest on Quinn Hughes's, like implicitly rest on Quinn Hughes or explicitly rest on Quinn Hughes's shoulders in this organization, how every single decision now is filtered through the, what is this going to mean for our chances of keeping Quinn Hughes? What will Quinn Hughes think about this? Does he like this coach? Will he be excited about acquiring this player? All of that is viewed through the lens of Quinn Hughes. And he kind of made the point of like, I get it, but does it become problematic at some point as well? And I want to try doing a thought experiment with us here, Drance.
You know, I'm always in for a thought experiment.
Let's say everything else about the Canucks is the same, except Quinn Hughes is under contract for six more years. Whatever math you have to do backwards to get that to work out, Quinn Hughes has six more seasons under contract with the Vancouver Canucks. So his future, will he re-sign? Not a talking point. So far in the distant future, only the most permanently stressed out and doomer Canucks fans are worried about that.
So most of them.
Yeah. But having said that, so Hughes under contract for six more years, but same questions about Pettersson, right? Tocchet just left. Everything else is the same. What would be the course of action you would be advocating? What would be the best course of action if everything else remained the same, with the exception that Quinn Hughes's contractual status was taken care of for the foreseeable future and you know you had him locked up?
Oh, man. I think the right course of action in that situation would almost certainly be to not accept that you're taking a step back so much as proceed with grafting aggregate value onto this roster as your top priority.
Would it almost be something akin to like the Alex Ovechkin-centered retool of the Washington Capitals? Where it's like, we have this guy and we want to be competitive around him and he's really important to the franchise. So we're not going to bottom out and do the full rebuild, but we're transitioning.
I think it would maybe be even more dramatic than that. To be totally honest with you, like, I think I'd be looking at this lineup and thinking to myself, oh boy, they are multiple elite pieces short, especially in the wake of, you know, losing JT Miller and Bo Horvat across, you know, an 18, 24-month span. I'd just be thinking, man, like, this is a team that's multiple. They're at least one and probably two elite pieces shy of a full deck if you want to, like, have the sort of juice required to compete with a team like Edmonton. I mean, think about it this way, right? At Canucks House W on Twitter, sent out just sort of like built a Puckpedia lineup, right? He's got DeBrusque, Pettersson, and then X
on the top line. Okay.
Joshua, X, Garland on the second line.
All right.
Hoglander, Hedel, Sherwood on the third line. Drew O'Connor, Ratu, Linus Karlsson on the fourth line. How many elite players are in that among that group? One?
You hope so.
Pettersson,
but you don't know.
Hope so. But Pettersson at least brings you elite upside, even if we have our
there are massive questions about whether it will be realized. Yeah.
How many top six? Outside of Pettersson, how many guys would you say have top line upside?
Top line upside.
Top line, not top six. Top line. Do you put Garland there? Do you put DeBrusk there?
I don't know if Garland's playing on your top line if you want to win the Stanley Cup.
And is Jake DeBrusk?
I don't think he is.
Is Jake DeBrusk? No.
I don't think he is.
So
maybe zero.
So you're two top line forwards short if Pettersson bounces back, which is a pretty significant parlay, right? Like, how many guys would you, like, do you see Joshua as a top six guy on a cup winner?
It's also contextual. Like, if he was your sixth best forward, right?
I think the answer is no, man.
Yeah, like probably
I think if you start trying to slice it fine, you've got your answer.
Yeah, that's fair.
Hoglander?
Not now.
The answer is no.
Could he be?
The answer is no. Just like, there's no need to slice this fine. Honestly, there's not.
Yeah.
You know, I think Hoglander, Joshua, Drew O'Connor, Filip Hedl, Sherwood are all like guys who could be contributing pieces on a championship team.
Yes.
But
in
the bottom six.
In the bottom six. Yeah.
Okay. So you are multiple top line forwards short, and I'd say an additional middle six forward short at least.
Yeah. You are best case scenario for Elias Pettersson. You're still two top line forwards and a good second line center short.
At least.
Those are the three that Jim Rutherford was talking about.
Well, good luck. Good luck. I don't know what else to say. Like, I don't think you're going to be able to acquire that with sort of that, like, caps model quickly enough. Now, the good thing is I do think Hughes's, like, statistical prime is going to be pretty unique. Obviously, he's going to, you know, you need to manage his minutes a little bit differently than the club did this year. I don't want to see him playing 28 minutes a night against Chicago and then 27 minutes a night against the Nashville Predators back-to-back games in late November because you're that thirsty for wins already at that point in the season. Like, that happened this year. That's not me pulling numbers out of thin air. That happened. That's how the team used Quinn Hughes repeatedly over the course of the season. I want to see him playing 30 minutes in Detroit because you're grinding out a comeback point against a non-playoff team in late November. Like, come on. But so long as they do that, I do think Quinn Hughes is going to be probably an elite player into his like mid-30s. Like, I'm never going to have the same level of concern about like how's Hughes going to age.
Right.
The way that I would with a normal player, in part because this player type, you know, whether it's Erik Karlsson, whether it's Chris Letang, whether it's Brian Campbell, like these guys seem to be able to skate all day and play, you know, and remain high-end contributors for much longer than like a power forward or a top center. Those sorts of guys do. So, yeah, I mean, for me anyway, I'd still be looking at it as like we probably need to take a calculated step back, which is not to say that we need to wave the white flag on making the playoffs, but let's shop in the bargain bin in free agency, and let's place some bets, relatively low cost, on guys, you know, in sort of like mid first rounders. I'd be looking at guys like Demko and Garland who are not extension eligible, and if they're not willing to sign, then I'd be trying to turn them into first rounders. Because here's like the secret about the Washington Capitals model, right? As much as people are like to talk about it as this like retool, which it was, to be very clear, this was not a tank job by any means. They always pick in the first round.
Yep.
Like, always.
Well, and then one year they at one point held, I think, 3 first-round picks, or was it just 2, and then they traded the one for Rasmus Sandin?
Right.
I remember that, right? Yeah. But, like, there was definitely a process, they got
that first for Orlov.
Yeah.
They sold at the deadline for Orlov and then bought at the deadline for Sandin and sort of got younger and more cost-controlled in the process. So, yeah, I mean, but they made a first-round pick in 24, 23, 22. They didn't in 21, 20. 2019, 2018. One of the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's discipline. That takes real discipline. And, you know, a lot of their success, like Ryan Leonard and Connor McMichael, like McMichael especially, but like Hendrix LaPierre has been good for them. He's won AHL championships. I love Miroshenko. Like, I'm still holding Miroshenko stock, even though he's not contributing to this team currently. And they, by the way, like in this season, a year where they won the East, they hold their first round pick. They also have a second and a third.
Must be nice.
I mean, they're not a team that throws that stuff overboard. They're not a team that. So, you know, I honestly think like you'd still be looking ahead. You'd be trying to accumulate high upside swings. I think you'd be like, I'd be really aggressively looking at the offer sheet route, I think, if I were the Canucks in with Hughes locked up long term. And I'd be selling out to just graft upside into my lineup, which, you know, draft picks are the way to do it. And young players, distressed young assets, like those would be the markets that I'd be playing in. And I think the difference between that and where the Canucks are with some of this Hughes uncertainty is I feel like they need slightly more name brand outcomes, as it were.
Yep.
In terms of addressing these holes in their forward group, then they could sort of afford, like you could go with sort of a little bit less certainty, a little bit more upside, a little bit lower cost, a little bit more keep your powder dry next season, as opposed to what I think this team has to do, which is fundamentally reimagine their top 6.
But don't you think there's a case to be made that the path you just laid out, which I don't think is particularly controversial, right? In the fantasy world where Quinn Hughes is locked up. Don't you think there's a case to be made that you should just do that anyways? That should just be the path forward anyways? And to the question of what will Quinn Hughes think about it, I think at a certain point you have to be able to sit your captain down, the guy that you want to build your team around, that is the face of your franchise, far and away the best player. You rave about his maturity and professionalism and all of that. To have a conversation with him and say, here is how we're going to build a Stanley Cup contender. It might not happen next year, but this is what we're going to do. This is our plan to find elite players to play alongside you that you can win a Stanley Cup with here. And again, hey, look, If there's a player out there who fits that bill, who happens to fall into our laps in a trade offer this summer, sure, we'll do that. But here's going to be the strategy, a not just this summer strategy, but a 2, 3, 4 year strategy to put that talent around you. And yeah, we realize you're only under contract for 2 more years, but we're hoping you'll stick around for a lot longer. Like, don't you have to be able to lay out that plan and trust that you can sell it to Quinn Hughes, but also that he has the understanding of, okay, well, that at least is a viable long-term plan. It feels like that has at least as much chance of success. I'm not saying it's a slam dunk. That's asking a lot from Quinn Hughes, from a guy who's going to be able to call his own shot. Justin Cuthbert said it earlier, right? Guys only get one career. They're going to be very, very picky about how they spend that career, very thoughtful about how they spend that career, what gives them the best chance to win. It's still going to be a hard sell, but I feel like it has at least as much of chance of success as we're going to do it over the course of a few months this summer. We're going to bring in all of the pieces we need to make us an elite contending team to appease Quinn Hughes. Like, people can push back against what I just laid out. It's like, well, it's not realistic. You can't expect him to stay and all yada, yada, yada. And that might be true. But if we're talking about unrealistic plans with very slim chances of success, like, the plan we're talking about fits that bill, too.
If we're talking about that, welcome to the Canucks offseason. I mean,
we're talking about,
we're talking about a trick shot.
You can't use lack of a chance of success as an argument against the long-term one when it also applies to the short-term one. And at least in the long-term plan, it's like, if Quinn Hughes leaves, it's like, well, at least we've been doing smart things anyways.
Well, it's like the IMAX and Dollywalls being like, a rebuild could take forever. And it's like, well, I'd take a chance at rebuilding and having something good as opposed to the certainty of being mid.
Yeah.
Right? Which is what, you know, effectively they've been manufacturing consent.
I just
for.
Like, let's manufacturing consent.
That's what they've done.
Classic Noam Chomsky textbook example of manufacturing consent.
Not to get dramatic.
It's just like, let's all, I do feel like there's just a, we should all understand we're talking Hail Marys here.
Yeah,
you know
what
I mean?
We're talking trick shots.
Like, we're talking big swings that are unlikely to succeed, but you have to choose a course. And once you frame it like that, because there's nothing safe about the go all in to try to bring in talent to impress Quinn Hughes path. Like, that is not a safe path by any stretch of the imagination.
It's far away from best practices.
Yes. It might still be the best option, but like, let's all acknowledge that there's no safe obvious, oh, that's probably will work out route here. That's not the situation the Canucks find themselves in. So once you, I think, accept that, you're like, okay, we're talking about different varieties of risk, different, maybe slightly different levels of risk, but mostly just different flavors of the risk you're willing to take on. And you start to think, let's do the really smart things. Let's just pretend we don't have to worry about Quinn Hughes. We'll sell him the plan. We respect his intelligence. We respect his maturity. We're going to lay it out, and we're going to get serious about building a contender in the medium and long term. And hopefully that's enough for him to stick around. And if it's not, we're going to do our best anyways. Like, that, I think you have to have the confidence in yourselves at a certain point to be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's so complicated because part of the allegations that the organization has to beat now is this sense that we're always rebuilding, right? And it's so funny. I've talked about this before, but a player's perspective on what a rebuild is, it's a binary. Are we trying to win or are we not trying to win, right? Whereas our perspective, like fans, the way that fans talk about an organization's direction is like very different than that, right? It's about, are you willing to sort of intelligently prioritize the long term while also competing and blah, 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 right? Like, my perspective is this organization refuses to rebuild and do the work necessary to accumulate enough talent that you could actually have a realistic shot at being one of 32 across, you know, 4 distinct management eras that's defined the last 15 years of Canucks hockey. But from the perspective of Canucks players, when they went to the bubble and then lost Tanev and Markstrom and Toffoli and Stetcher and Levo too, that set them up for a rebuilding season.
You don't hear Levo thrown in very often.
Well, you don't hear Stetcher thrown in that often
no,
either.
Stetcher usually gets thrown in. Levo, that's a deep cut.
Well, Levo is the fifth of five UFAs. Like the truth of it, it was you didn't.
He
sign
went to Calgary too, didn't he?
Yeah, you didn't sign a single one of your expiring UFAs, so that's why Levo gets mentioned. When the club then sort of goes through, they gather themselves after the disappointment of 21. They have the Bruce. There it is. Bump season. Club fails again. Bo Horvat gets traded.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're rebuilding again. We traded Bo Horvat. We're selling Luke Shen at the deadline. Like, this is another rebuilding season, our second in 3 years. Now, it's not. The club traded the first-round pick they got back for Horvat for win now help. They absolutely did not rebuild. They just sort of reloaded. But from the perspective of guys in the room,
perception
you lose
of
a player,
taking a step back.
You lose a player like Bo Horvat, and you sell at the deadline, and that's another year where we're rebuilding. And then you trade JT Miller this season after the dream year of 2023-24, right? You lose Zadorov, right? You lose Lindholm. Players were openly advocating, trying to convince Lindholm to stay. Then you trade JT Miller. It's a third rebuild. We are always rebuilding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine having that. Imagine working for this team, playing for this team, and having the perspective that the Canucks' problem is that they're always rebuilding. It's preposterous, but that's in a narrow sense.
Well, not even that they're always rebuilding, just that they're always taking a step back, right? They're always, there's always talent going out the door.
Right. But that's not how they would view it, as we are always rebuilding.
Yeah.
That is how it's viewed by Canucks players internally. I'm telling you, like 100%. And that's the allegation that the Canucks need to beat from Quinn Hughes' perspective. I don't want to sign up for a perpetual rebuild.
Again,
I know.
It's wild. I get that. I understand that. You think of like Dylan Larkin, right? His comments after, like, man,
totally.
I really wanted a trade. Really, we really wanted help at the trade deadline. I get that's how players think. Yeah. If we talk about the partnership between your franchise player and the organization, you have to be able to sell a different vision. And if there's just no interest in that vision, the writing might be on the wall then, and you have to operate in a certain way. But again, it would be one thing if it was, hey, this is a team on the cusp of taking that jump forward, and you can see the Stanley Cup contender here, and if you just nail that one trade, that's going to make a world of difference, and Quinn Hughes is going to want to stay. If you were talking about one trade that you had to nail, that's a very different conversation than what we're having, where it's two, three acquisitions that you need to bring in, and you have to balance, like, yeah, it is the most, with in an ideal world, the easiest thing to do maybe to convince Quinn Hughes to stay would be add two or three top six players, two or three needle moving players. But you have to factor in the degree of difficulty. You know what I mean? And if the chance of success becomes so minuscule, in a blue sky world, that might be what Quinn Hughes wants to see, but you got to be honest with yourself about your ability to provide that.
Yeah.
And if you can't provide it, then you got to go looking for other options that you can provide.
I mean, look, the truth is that there are multiple players that would fit the bill for what we're talking about. Difference making, needle moving top six guys.
Yeah.
Available without acquisition cost in 6 weeks or 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we expect the Canucks to get a seat at the table to even pitch those guys.
Doesn't sound like Jim Rutherford expects to.
Now you have to consider that that's the same decision, albeit with a greater degree of familiarity and sense of obligation, that Quinn Hughes is going to be considering himself in, not a ton of time, like in a year, 14 months, basically, till July 1, 2026. If you're not going to be able to get a seat at the table to pitch Ehlers and Marner and Sam Bennett if he shakes loose, I mean, that is a bad sign for that sort of effort. So, look, I always believe that the way to view a team's relationship with players, even star players in a world where star players matter so much more in terms of determining outcomes, right? Like, one thing for all the sort of tone of our conversation to remember is, like, Canucks missed the playoffs by 7 points in a year where Pettersson,
a lot went wrong,
was a ghost of himself, and Quinn Hughes was injured after 50 games, right? Like, from game 50 on,
well, and they traded JT Miller. they traded JT Miller.
He's not coming back.
No, sure, but
you
like
trade JT Miller, yeah, you don't have JT Miller. Like that's why
fair.
I'm not
that's
including.
Fair. Okay, I see. Of things that could change next year, you're saying. I see.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying like Pettersson doesn't have to bounce back entirely. He doesn't have to be the, you know, picking his teeth with top line opposition that he has occasionally hit over the course of his career. But if he's just a good 1C, 65 to 75 point guy, like that's a huge boost over what he provided this season. And if Quinn Hughes stays healthy throughout, I mean, there's very few guys who impact the game more. Like you get that and 40 games of Demko, and I mean, you at least have a puncher's shot at being a playoff team. You shouldn't be priced as more than like plus 150 to make it, you know? So it's like, it's not like we're starting from the bottom of an absolute well from the perspective of this team having like a fun season that's worth following next year. But that next level of like getting to the playoffs and having a real shot and not needing a favorable draw against a Nashville Predators team that outplays you, but you are able to survive. Not relying on an Edmonton Oilers goalie meltdown to make that series look like it was close. That layer feels pretty inaccessible as we sort of sit here and think about what the Canucks could do this offseason. In terms of partnering with the star player that can sort of most make it happen, I do think that partnership element matters. And at some point, you've got to have the sort of self-respect to just sell a vision as opposed to bend over backwards.
Here's what we're doing, and we think it's going to work.
Yep.
And we want you to be a part of it, but this is the path forward. We're not chasing the stars or the pie in the sky stuff this year. We'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. Tomorrow on the show, big crossover Wednesday, and Jason Buchla, of course. We can get more into Canucks' options with the 15th overall pick, should they choose to keep it and make a selection at that spot. That's on the show tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.